Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase, every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Hacks is back for season 3, and so is the official Hacks podcast. In each episode, Hacks creators Lucia Aniello, Paul W. Downs, and Jen Statsky speak with cast and crew members to unpack the Emmy-winning comedy series.
You'll hear Hannah Einbinder and Jean Smart speak to their on-screen dynamic, along with stories from the show's writer's room, on-set antics, and creating the world that Deborah and Ava inhabit. Watch Hacks, streaming exclusively on Max, and listen to the official Hacks podcast on Max or wherever you get your podcasts.
Look out, it's Brett Goldstein. Listen, I'm taking a few weeks off to focus on some work. Hope you understand. In the meantime, I'm releasing some of my all-time favourite, all-time classic episodes, including this one with Patton Oswalt. You think I like films? He fucking loves films. This was an amazing episode. It's the first time I met Patton. He was so wonderful, so lovely. It's such a good episode. You get all the extras and the video and the whole episode uncut and ad-free at the Patreon, patreon.com/Brett Goldstein. Watch Shrinking on Apple TV Plus. There's 3 episodes left to go this season. And then on March 15th, Ted Lasso Season 3 will premiere. I hope you'll all watch it. I hope you all love it. I hope everyone is well. So that is it for now. I very much hope you enjoy this episode of Films to be Buried with Rewind Classic with Patton Oswalt. And welcome to Films to be Buried with. It is I, Brett Goldstein, and I am joined today by an actor, a writer, a stand-up, a sketchman, a comic book artist, an award winner, a documentarian, a multi-award winner, a father, a husband, a lover, a superstar, a saint, and a genius, and a hero. Please welcome to the show, the incredible Patton Oswalt!
Oh my God! Hang on, I'm just updating my IMDb. That was fantastic. I gotta wait a minute, putting all that in there. Thank you. Thanks, Brett.
Hey, thanks so much for doing this. How are you?
Oh, yeah, I am great this morning. How are you doing?
I'm all right.
It's evening. It's evening or afternoon where you are, right?
It's evening now. It's evening.
Oh, that's so nice.
You got up early to do this.
I did.
Appreciate you.
No, my pleasure.
I have to ask. How's your pandemic treating you?
My pandemic is treating all of us in America pretty bad because we don't have someone modeling good behavior. I would imagine there's a lot of Americans looking to New Zealand right now.
Yeah.
They're out there. They're going to concerts and having dinner together and going to movies. And we are still indoors trying our best to catch up on shows on Amazon and Netflix, but there's not a lot. I mean, look, the pandemic is treating us as badly as the behavior that's being modeled, which is really chaotic and really nuts. So, yeah.
Is it true you did an hour of stand-up online? Is that how that works?
2 nights ago, I went on, did a live streaming thing on this place called On Location Live, and it was me doing a new hour of material into this little camera on my laptop. And like every other comedian that I've seen do it, I was not going to do it. I was offered it a few months ago and I said, but then friends of mine like Maria Bamford and Mike Birbiglia and Brian Posehn were doing it. And I said, okay, well, maybe I need to, I didn't want to be the vaudevillian that refused to be on TV. Like if this is where the technology is going, maybe I should become comfortable with it on one level or another. So I did it. And just like I predicted, the first 10 minutes, I'm speaking really fast and constantly referencing that there's no one there. And you can see, you could hear my mouth getting dry and kind of smacky because I'm so nervous. And then I just kind of rolled with it and it became looser. And there were moments like right now, like I was talking, but I didn't even need to look at the camera. It felt like sitting with someone in a restaurant and going, who was the guy? It had that feeling.
Well, you just sat down, did it?
This is where, we looked around the house and my wife, Meredith, thank God, arranged like an actual background for me, because if she hadn't been there, it just would have been some weird, blurry, creepy, like I wouldn't have bothered with the aesthetic or set design. So thank God I had an equivalent of a Beau Welch, if you know about production design, who came in and let's make this look good. So thank goodness.
Wow. I've done a few online gigs, and in England, there's one gig that has nailed it, which is there's a gig called Always Be Comedy, which you ever in London, you must do. But what they've done is they've made a Zoom where, so if there's like 200 people on it, 50 of them are mic'd up, and their mics are up and they're in boxes. So you can hear, you actually have feedback, and it makes such a difference.
I've seen that on a couple of these gigs, and I know they're working on that technology. I would love that. The next time I do it, I want to do that mic thing. But I know that some of the platforms, if they mic the people, then it mutes you out. But I guess they figured it out. They cracked that code. Yeah. So, oh, that's got to be so. So you've done some of these shows where you get like a...
Where you get people. Because I did one where you're just doing it into the void. And
Oh, yikes.
It's horrible because you are just the whole time going, is it?
Yeah.
Is anyone... So is anyone there? Have I lost my mind? It's horror.
You feel like am I the insane survivor in the post-apocalyptic film who's the film was like, I don't know if anyone's receiving this transmission, but here's how it happened. I'm the only like you, that's how you have that feeling.
And also we're not built for it. Like what you've been trained for is to like react to laughter and pauses. What you're also trained for is if you hear silence, it's going badly.
Yes.
So when you're doing these, you're like, it's going badly. No. Your instincts are.
And also you're trained to, if you do say something that really lands, then you want that moment to coast on the laughter so the audience builds some confidence in you. So if you're talking, and there were 3,500 people on the feed. That's how many tickets sold. But so for all I know, there were a couple of jokes that really landed, and I just kept talking through the laughter, and they're just like, the fuck is wrong with this guy? Like, why isn't he? Give me a second here. So you're right. It's bad both ways. You need to acknowledge the silence. You also need to acknowledge if there's any success, and I wasn't doing either one, which is, you look like an insane person, you know?
Well, listen, I've been catching up on your stuff. I watched I Love Everything this morning.
Oh, loved thanks,
it,
man.
Absolutely loved it. I was a huge fan of Annihilation. Thought it was amazing.
Thank you. Thank you.
Of all the things you've done, and you've done many wonderful things, but the one that I talk about the most and I'm slightly obsessed with is the film Young Adult, which I think is not seen enough. And when I did the greatest movies of the last decade special, Young Adult was on that list. Because I'm like, it's a fucking... And I watched it again the other day. Oh, it is bold. That is a bleak.
It has that early 70s bleak boldness of when they're, because the early 70s was that golden era of movies where they were ballsy enough to have protagonists that they would defiantly not change. Yeah. And the thrill was getting to the end of their story and going, oh, they're just digging in even deeper. Oh, and that actually happens. Like that happens to people. That's a real thing. And you're so not used to seeing that on screen, that that's really startling to that moment at the end when, again, my favorite scene in the movie is between her and the actress who plays my sister, Colette Wolfe, where maybe you're thinking, and they do that great tease where when she's coming out of the bedroom from spending the night with me and you're thinking, hey, maybe she's softened a bit. And then she runs into my sister and my sister puts her right back on the track that she like, oh, you're just like, no, don't talk to that woman. It's so, it's amazing. It's so amazing, that scene.
And you're phenomenal in it. And the final scene with you and her makes me cry. I think it's beautiful. It's such a good film. And also, I hadn't seen a film when I saw it at the cinema where the lead who you are connected to and you do care about her, to have her mission be the moment where she kisses Patrick Wilson, literally half the audience went ugh, and half the audience sort of went yay, like everyone was so confused by
exactly. You don't have any solid footing. Again, like in real life, there are moments where she does things, you're like, well, that's pretty cool, and then other moments you're like, what a fucking horrible, what is she doing? And so you're right, you don't know how to feel in that moment. Also, the fact that someone pointed this out to me, and they never talk about it, she's playing an alcoholic.
Oh,
and if you notice, in the nighttime scenes in the bar, she's so put together. She's just gorgeous and quick-witted. But then those moments when she's walking around in the sunshine and she looks so withered and reduced, and the fact that she let herself look like that, like usually actresses are like, in the sunlight, I need to sparkle. Yeah. And she looks like she wants to crawl into a sewer when she's walking around in the daylight. Like, just such an amazing performance that she went that far with
it. Yeah, she's incredible in it. And the storytelling in it, it's all the stuff that's not in it. Like, we don't hear about her marriage. We don't, and the fact that she has this dog that she, you know, there's this element of her that wants to love something. And you, there's all this stuff, and it's so, fuck, it's a good film. What a film.
Well, but the fact that that's what's so great is, again, like those really great movies, the fact that she never even thinks to bring up her marriage or ever reference it tells you everything you need to know about that marriage.
Yeah.
It was a catastrophe and she just, there's no connection to it.
Yeah.
That tells you all you need to know. So, oh yeah. Okay. I get it now. I know exactly what's happening.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
You're genuinely brilliant in it and I love it.
That's Thank you.
That's all I wanted to say. Good night.
Thanks. All right. Thanks for having me
on. Cheers. Oh, but I have forgotten to tell you something.
No, dude, I gotta go. I got four other podcasts.
No, wait. This is quite important, actually, and I should have told you this before I told you about the other stuff.
No, I'm doing films to be. I'm doing films to be cremated with in 5 minutes, and then I'm doing films to be buried at sea with.
Right. And then well, just before you go, I've got to tell you, it's really important. I'm just gonna have to say it. fuck. You died.
Oh, no.
How did you die? Sorry. How did you die?
Well, oh, God, this is so embarrassing. You know what? I'm just going to tell you.
Yeah. Let's just be open with each other, please.
I'm going to be very open with you. I did. Oh, God. This is so typical, too. Like, everyone's going to go, well, yeah, duh. Of course, that's how he died. I did the tasting menu at the French Laundry up in Yountville. Right. And when I sat down, the chef said, you can have the 9-course or the 17 course. And I went, oh, I want the, give me the 17 course. Mm-hmm. What I didn't know is at the French Laundry, every course is, it's course one is A and B. So you taste one thing and then a second thing. There's actually 34 courses. So by the time we got to there, and there's a salt course, there's a butter course. Literally, they bring out a thing of butter that you just eat, taste the butter. So by the time we got to the pork course, I was feeling like, oh, I think like there's not as much air is going through my esophagus as normally. I'm feeling a little, I think like food is getting blocked up. And I should have just said, you know what, let me box the desserts. But I had to show off. I had to show off to everyone else at the table. I'm going to power all the way through. And by the time we got to, there was like a molten mocha crystalline egg. And that is the one, a shard from the egg went down my throat, lodged sideways, and it prevented me. And look, I choked out on a whimsical molten mocha crystalline egg in front of Brad Bird and Paul Thomas Anderson and Christopher Nolan at a director's fortnight. And it was, I know. And
was,
none of them.
It was 34. It was course 34.
Exactly. If I had just stopped at 30. Oh, God. You had to bring that up.
No,
see,
I'm
that's
sorry,
what kills me.
Yeah.
I could have walked away. And the other thing that killed me is it was weird because it was sort of pleasurable because the oxygen kind of left my brain and I had this wonderful meal in front of me. Mm-hmm. But the thing was, I looked at all of the directors and all I could see was any one of them could have jumped up and given me the Heimlich. But I could see Brad going, oh, I could use this so brilliantly in like an animated movie. And then Nolan was like, oh, this could be a really cool beginning to one of these weird reversal, you know, like time loop kind of movies. Yeah. And then Paul Thomas Anderson will be like, oh, this would be one of like 11 deaths in the giant patchwork film that I'm going to make about
eggs.
About Tarzana, California that I'll do in like 5 years. And we'll get Josh Gad. We'll play this and he'll die on a crystalline egg. This is perfect. I could just see them making notes for their movies. That was a little painful. That was a little hurtful.
So as you were choking to death, they're just making notes.
Yeah.
That's directors for you, isn't it?
I'm not going to name it. One of them clearly had the notes function on his iPhone open, but under the tables, I couldn't see it. And he was, I'm not going to say which one, but that was so clearly happening.
Well, it wasn't Nolan because he doesn't like having mobile phones.
Exactly.
So that narrows it down.
All right. Okay. Good guess, but I'm not gonna say which one. But I will say
it was Bird. Come on.
It was a pleasurable death, but it was a frustrating death. And I'll leave it at that.
Wow.
Yeah. Damn you, Thomas Keller.
Wow. What a shocking, what an absolutely shocking way to go. Do you worry about death? Do you think, is it something that keeps you up at night, your own death?
I mean, obviously, I've experienced death very, very close and firsthand. But as far as my death is concerned, I'm more concerned. This is going to sound a little too philosophical. Like, I've done a lot of the things that I wanted to do. There's other things that I do want to do, but I don't feel like it's essential to the world if I do them or not. Like, I did the things that were essential to me. Now I can do the things that are like more of my caprices and more fun. I'm such a fan of other people that I know, other comedians, other writers, other filmmakers. The ones I worry about are, there are some young up-and-coming people that, this is going to sound really weird, and I hope she doesn't get pissed at me for saying this. I worry about like a Phoebe Waller-Bridge dying, because she clearly has decades of amazing work in her, and I don't want her to, like, I want her in a protective bubble, and I want to see whatever it is she has coming. It, like, when I remember watching Fleabag, I was like, this is what it must have been like to see like Martin Scorsese's Who's That Knocking at My Door and going, oh, no one, please, this guy, make sure this guy stays alive for a long time. I want to see what this guy's going to do. You know, so it's that kind of feeling. And that's such a weird thing, but I do worry about certain musicians and filmmakers and writers. Like, let them keep going. Go protect them. To me, that's what matters to me. I think, you know what? I think the reason that I dwell on that is because I was pretty good friends with Mitch Hedberg back in the day, back in San Francisco. And then we moved to LA around the same time. And then he's one of those guys that, and everyone has someone like this, but it's like, he was such an absolutely brilliant writer. And there was decades of work that we didn't get to see out of him and that he didn't get to create. And that has always bothered me. You know, and we weren't like deep, close, personal friends, but we'd see each other all the time and we would talk, and I was just always excited to see him. It was always like, oh, this is a thing that I'm always going to get to look forward to. He's always going to have some amazing new joke. And then for him to just be gone like that was like, well, and that sounds very selfish, but it's like, why does he not get to keep putting things into the world?
Yeah. Well, it sounds sort of the opposite of selfish.
Yeah. I don't know.
Do you believe in an afterlife? How do you see it? If I may ask.
God, the thing that haunts me about the afterlife, no pun intended, is a line from Neil Gaiman's Sandman comic book. Did you ever read The Sandman?
Yeah. I just started it, actually.
Look, God, there's a line where Dream's older sister, Death, someone asks, like, where do people go when they die? And then she says, people go where they think they ought to go, which means that at the last moment, does that mean, like, if your subconscious truly is eating you alive with guilt, it will set, like, it will create a place for you to go. That is, you know what I mean? So that's always really, because there's very positive and very negative connotations to that idea. Personally, I would love if the afterlife was exactly as Albert Brooks describes it in Defending Your Life. That is such a wonderful system. The only thing that I find unrealistic about that movie is, if I was in Judgment City and you could eat food and it doesn't affect you, I would just have a backpack full of like fried rice or, but like, I would just never not be eating. That's all I'd be doing. The fact that he like can take bites of things and then wander away, I'm like, what are you doing? You know, that idea of you move forward if you conquer your fear, there's something really beautiful about that.
I've never heard that, and that's going to scare me forever.
Well, what is your conception? Do you have a conception of the afterlife? Because I love hearing that from other people.
It keeps changing. I do think we keep going round.
Oh.
I do think that. I think that we keep going round until we get better. But I think that there's a bit in between you coming back. Well, this is the only bit I don't get. I've talked about this before, but I believe this is the Buddhist way of reincarnation, and the only bit that annoys me about it is that you forget, is that you when you start again, you forget everything you learned in the last life, which seems an inefficient way of getting better at it. But you do meet people who are, you know, people say, like, oh, he's an old soul or she's an old, you know, and it feels correct to me. You meet people who feel like they're new and people who feel like they've been here a while. You know what I mean?
Yeah. What if we find out later that, like, there are certain forms of schizophrenia that are just a form of reincarnation that's fritzed out a little bit, that you're hearing your other lives, but it's all at once and it's not coming in an orderly fashion. Yes. And that's why people that are quote unquote insane can often have these really amazing insights into things beyond what we can do. It's because there are too many channels that are open to other lives and that's what they're funneling into themselves.
Yes.
That'd be interesting. But that's, I never thought of it that way. That, yeah, it is an inefficient system. If what your aim is to improve us, maybe, but then maybe the way the people that are getting close to reaching that are the old souls. And I know exactly what you're talking about. There's people that I've met. I had a friend put it this way. You ever just meet certain people and you're like, this person just gets the deal.
Yeah.
And people are just drawn to them. And it has nothing to do with them, whether they're a celebrity or not. Like, you can go to like a bar and look at the staff, and there's like one member on the staff that everyone, they're just the natural, they're just, people are drawn to them, you know? And I just read this oral history of the making of Dazed and Confused.
Oh, really?
It's called All Right, All Right, All Right. It is fascinating. They go through the making of it. And Matthew McConaughey, I think, is one of those old souls where he was just a guy that they hired for the day. And then they became very clear, oh, wait a minute, write him more. He was just so connected to all this other stuff. And they saw it on film. They're like, well, this is obviously, you just, you know, there's just certain people. That's how it is.
I'm thinking about it now that we're talking about it, because I haven't thought about it in a while. You know, I think you're born with certain characteristics and morality and certain things. And everyone is born with like a box, and everyone's box is different, right?
Yeah.
And maybe that what's in your box is from your previous lives, what the things you've accrued.
Yeah. But the point is, you don't know ahead of time specifically what each item is and what it's linked to. And that part of your life is figuring out how those items fit together. It's like the there's a Philip K. Dick short story called Paycheck, where a guy who, he's like an agent that is sent into the future to do things. And then when they come back, they wipe your memory. He's like a corporate assassin type. But he leaves himself this envelope full of weird items that don't mean anything to himself in the present, but they save his life as he's going along. And that's like a version of that, of getting that box and having it. Isn't that weird?
I like that a lot.
Yeah, yeah. That's such a cool, the idea of an old soul. I never thought of it that way.
And you meet kids, you meet, there is a vast difference between kids. Some are really dumb and some are amazing.
That's one thing that Meredith says, and she goes, I feel terrible saying it, but there's certain kids you meet, and they're like, they're just shitty kids.
Yeah.
Like, this is just a shitty person. This is a tiny shitty person who's going to grow up to be an older shitty person, and there's nothing you can – you don't want to be mean to them, but it's like, early. It's just so fucking clear. They're just terrible, you know?
They're on the early – they're newcomers.
Yeah. Yes. You're right. There was a very famous
– they're rookies.
Oh my God, they're, what if shitty people are just rookies?
They're just rookies.
And you should be trying to help. You're like, oh, he's just a rookie. He doesn't know any better. He's trying. There was an interview, Carl Reiner was on The Tonight Show in the early 60s, and Johnny Carson was like, who's the funniest person you know? And he's like, this kid who lives down the street from me, because Carl Reiner lived next to this guy, that old vaudeville performer, Park Your Carcass. But he was talking about, he was like, this kid's, his name is Albert Einstein. That his dad gave him the name Albert Einstein. This kid's like 13. He's the funniest kid I've ever met in my life. It was Albert Brooks.
Oh, yeah.
That's what he was talking about. And he was like, I would go over to my friend. His father was this very famous vaudevillian, and Carl Reiner knew him. And Carl would go visit the guy's dad. And then it would just, and also his son Rob was friends with Albert Brooks. But he was like, this kid is the funniest person I've ever met. And he's just a 13-year-old. Like, we've all met people like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I want to talk about this all day, but listen, I've got a spoiler for you, which is there is a heaven. And actually, not everyone who comes on this podcast would agree, but I think you'd fucking love this one because A, you've got a backpack filled with infinite food that doesn't affect you. And B, everyone's obsessed with films there. They're obsessed with it.
Oh.
And not in an annoying way.
Yes.
And all they want to do, and other things if you like, but mostly what I want to do is talk to you about your life, but through film.
Let's do it.
And the first thing they ask you
Hell yeah.
Is what is the first film that you remember seeing?
The first film, and I remember this so clearly. And before I tell this story, I'm not slagging the parents involved in the story. They had every good intention when they did what they did. This was in the early just hang on.
Okay.
Because this was like in 1973 or four. Us, you know, like, you know, 4 years old, 5 years old, living in Southern California. My dad was in the military, so this is very briefly we lived there before we moved to Virginia. But it was Halloween, and they had a children's Halloween activity day at the local library. Won't this be fun? And we did cut out pumpkins, and we made ghost cookies, and they told ghost stories. And then they showed us a movie. And it being the early 70s, and there's no internet or no parental resources, they thought, oh, let's show them an old silent horror movie. This will be because silent movies, that's for everybody. How scary can this be? No one. And they showed us, they projected it on a wall on a 16 millimeter projector. Because back then, by the way, you could rent 8 millimeter and 16 millimeter films. That's how people would watch them. They showed us F.W. Murnau's Nosferatu to a bunch of 5 and 6 year olds.
Shit out.
And by the way, earlier this year, I watched Nosferatu. There's a film service called Canopy. I'm like, I'm going to watch this again just to make sure, like, maybe I'm only seeing it through my 5-year-old brain. That is one of the most terrifying, just openly disturbing film. It's all it is disturbing images. And the narrative kind of doesn't make sense. There's kind of a dream logic to it. It just kind of jumps around. So it has that 5-year-old's logic way of looking at the world where just all it is scary stuff coming in. Kids were screaming and crying, and I was freaking out, but I was very, very fascinated by how come this little square of light is making everyone. We were just in this room that was well lit. We know we're in safe in the world. They put a couple of towels over the windows, and suddenly we're in hell. Yeah. Like, it just completely. And I'm like, how did that happen? And that is why I've been fascinated with film ever since, because it happened like that. And that movie, go watch Nosferatu.
It's fucking scary.
It's fucking, by today's standards, that movie is fucked up. Ugh.
It is. It's really, it's just a series of openly disturbing images.
It's like, what the fuck? And then the woman has, like, dies at the end. Like, she openly sacrifices herself. Like, it's so fucked up.
So were you with your parents watching this?
I think it was a drop-off. Like, the 70s were all about, just leave your kids there and we'll cut. I mean, I remember very clearly you were a shitty parent if your kid was inside your home watching TV and being supervised. The good parents were like, really? Go outside, play, run around, get exercise, come back when it gets dark. I don't care where you go, go outside. And that was it. That was like, just, that's what you did. You know, so that, yeah, I'm sure they dropped me off
and then picked you up and you were shaking. Like, what happened in there?
Oh, how were the pumpkin cookies? There's a guy. He came out of the darkness and he's just like sucking people's souls. It was just like so terrifying. Yeah.
Do you want to go back tomorrow? Got that. Amazing.
They're going to show Hacks and Witchcraft Through the Ages.
And you have a brother, right?
I have a little brother, yeah, my brother Matt.
How much younger is he?
He's a year and a half younger than me.
So was he there? Were you together?
I cannot remember. He doesn't remember seeing that movie. He doesn't have that memory. Maybe he was there and just, I don't know, but that's a good question, but he's never, he doesn't remember that. I very specifically remember seeing that.
He's just shut down that trauma and lives in denial. I get it.
Yeah, maybe his brain was like, no, we're not going to deal with this yet. You're too young.
What film, Patton Oswalt, made you cry the most? Are you a crier?
Yes. Here's what's weird, though. I don't cry in movies when things are sad. Mm-hmm. I mean, I still do cry when things are really sad. Like, I remember very specifically the baby mind sequence from Dumbo always wipes me. I mean, my God in heaven. But the moment in movies and in art that makes me cry is when someone decides to be good to someone else in spite of the world going, it'd be so much easier if you just were shitty. And they're like, no, God damn it, I'm going to step. So there's a moment in the Bad News Bears when Walter Matthau, and he acts rough doing it because he needs to, when he decides I'm going to actually coach this team. And it's like, God damn it, no one's vote counts but mine. We're going to, like, and he's going to actually, because these kids have been humiliated. And he does that little speech about this quitting thing, you know, it's a hard habit once you start. And you realize he's talking about his own life. And he's like, you know, just because I found a way to be comfortable with pissing my life away. I don't have to dump this on these kids. And that scene, there's something so beautiful about that. Whenever someone steps up for someone else. Yeah. The most recent time that happened was in Jojo Rabbit. At the end, when Sam Rockwell, when he sacrifices himself to save Jojo, and when they're dragging him away and he's smiling like he's safe. I mean, I was crying so hard in the theater. I mean, I saw the premiere. I went to the premiere. Oh, wow. And I was just bawling in that moment when people step the hell up and go, no, I'm just such a sucker for that.
Yeah.
That's what makes me cry the most.
I fucking love Jojo Rabbit.
And I saw that 4 times.
It's so good.
It's so good.
And it's one of them films. There was another film last year, Vice. Both Jojo Rabbit and Vice were divisive in a way that I was like, what? this is like objectively an incredible film. What?
I remember very specifically the Jojo Rabbit arguments where people were arguing about just like aesthetics, mm-hmm. or they were arguing about things out of context. And it's like, this is a story, if you read The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, he was not diminishing Nazism to link it with Beatlemania, because that is how it was. They literally designed Hitler's speeches the way a rock promoter would promote a up-and-coming band. You book a venue that's too small so that afterwards you can go, oh, we couldn't fit anyone in there. There were a lot, like, and they would sell pamphlets outside. It was literally the same mechanics as a rock concert, which makes it that much more frightening. That's why he did it the way he did it.
Yeah.
You know, so there are movies that come out that are divisive. And I'm like, what in the fuck are you people arguing about? This is so good.
You dope.
So I cry in movies like, you know what the weirdest movie I've ever cried in was for that reason? Is Akira Kurosawa's Yojimbo, when Sanjuro, the bodyguard, Toshirô Mifune, gets all angry about when he realizes that that family, they've kidnapped the wife and he's actually helped. He's part of it. It's an earlier version of Sam Jackson realizing, oh, I'm the tyranny of evil men. I'm the actual, I've got to step up and do something good. And he's like, people like this, oh God, they make me sick. And then he just picks up his sword and goes to slaughter everyone to rescue this family. And it's like, oh God, he's doing something. Like, I just love moments like that.
It's going to be good. I love
that. Sorry. Next question. I'm sorry about that.
No, I really like that. What, other than Nosferatu, what's the film that scared you the most?
Oh, this is another quick story about well-meaning 1970s parents who did not know what they were doing. They were not trying to fuck us up. I remember this very specifically. Me and my friend, Bruce Beardsley, wanted to go see Ralph Bakshi's Lord of the Rings, the animated Lord of the Rings. Mm-hmm. Oh, we want to go see it because we love Dungeons and Dragons. Bruce's dad took us. Great guy. Great dad. We go to the theater. Lord of the Rings is sold out. There's no tickets. And what else is playing? It's 1978 or 79. Oh, Invasion of the Body Snatchers. They remade it. His dad was like, I saw Invasion of the Body Snatchers growing up. That's a fun. Yeah, fine. We'll go see Invasion of the Body Snatchers. That movie, I had so many nightmares. I mean, for weeks, my mom was, I remember my mom even called Bruce's dad and was like, why did you take, he's like, I thought it was just this, I didn't know it was going to be that mess. I couldn't sleep. The Donald Sutherland Invasion of the Body Snatchers. And by the way, I went and rewatched that a few years ago just to confirm it wasn't just my 10-year-old head. Yeah. That's a fucking terrifying movie. And it's designed to fuck with you. The aliens win at the end. They fucking win. Earth is fucking destroyed. That final shot of Donald Sutherland, you're like, what the fuck? But also, I read this. This was really weird. Philip Kaufman, the director, the sound design. When you watch the beginning of the movie, there's there's your standard city sounds, mm-hmm. birds, traffic, machines, you know, the sound of life. And as the movie goes on, each of those sounds drops out of the soundtrack. Oh. So by the end, there's no animal sounds, there's no cars, there's no city, because all of that is shut down, but they do it very subtly. And that's why the last half hour of the movie, you're so unnerved, because there's no point of reference to grab onto to feel like it's life anymore.
That's fucking brilliant.
And again, imagine that working on a 10-year-old's brain. Like, it's just so fucking scary. Oh God, that movie fucked me up.
That's fucking smart.
Yeah. Isn't that brilliant?
Yeah, that's brilliant. I love shit like that.
It's just, I mean, you've seen that movie, right?
I know Donald Sutherland's in my, I fucking love Donald Sutherland. Do you know this about him? I'm sure you do. You know everything. But the thing, and I would love to be famous enough that I had this sort of clout, but apparently Donald Sutherland, when he signs up for a film, part of his deal is, do you know this?
No.
His contract, his deal, he'll do the film if you shoot the middle first. As long as they shoot the middle first, he'll do the film, because he's like, if I'm still finding the character, if we film the middle, by the time we film the beginning, I'll have the character and I'll be good. So that as an audience, by the time you get to the middle, you won't notice if I'm a bit shit in the middle because I've sold it at the beginning.
That's brilliant.
Brilliant.
But also, the middle of the movie is usually when the characters are having all their doubts and all their second thoughts. So if he is flailing a little bit, that actually also fits. Holy shit, that's genius.
It's good, isn't it?
Oh my God. And,
honestly, whenever I've, the few times I've had acting jobs, if there ever is discussions about schedule and like what would work for you, I'm always like, oh, we could shoot the middle. We could do the middle stuff, couldn't we? Let's do the middle.
If I ever get the clout, I am so doing that. Holy crap.
Gotta do the middle.
That's amazing.
Smart, isn't it? I always get nervous. Every job I've had where it's like, we're filming the first scene first, I'm always like, oh, shit.
What if I don't? Yeah, that's what's weird. If you watch The Godfather, James Caan, early on, like the first couple of days of filming, he didn't have the Sonny character down 100%, hadn't quite figured it out. And then he apparently went and saw Don Rickles and then was like, I'm going to play him like that. And then for the rest of the movie, he's Don Rickles. Wow. And he does the bada-bing, you got to do it. And you can see the change. If you know that going in, the early scenes, you're like, that's not quite Sonny. And you're like, there he is. So it's really cool to see that. Yeah. But God, that's a brilliant, you shoot the middle for real.
Hacks is back for season 3, and so is the official Hacks podcast. In each episode, Hacks creators Lucia Aniello, Paul W. Downs, and Jen Statsky speak with cast and crew members to unpack the Emmy-winning comedy series. You'll hear Hannah Einbinder and Jean Smart speak to their on-screen dynamic, along with Hacks writer and actor Pat Regan, on how their improv experience helped them when shooting scenes and what it was like writing scripts for specific actors.
You'll also hear from crew members like the costume designers on what it was like creating the world that Deborah and Ava inhabit. Hear stories from the show's writer's room, on-set antics, and more. Watch Hacks streaming exclusively on Max, and listen to the official Hacks podcast on Max or wherever you get your podcasts.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Patton Oswalt. What film is not critically acclaimed? People do not like it generally, but you love it, and you love it so much you don't even care what anyone says. You just think everyone's an idiot. This film's amazing.
I mean, it doesn't get the credit for the genius stuff that it does, although it did get some good reviews, but I think it should be like a Criterion disc.
Right.
Is John McNaughton's Wild Things with Matt Dillon and Neve Campbell and Bill Murray. It is a really smart noir hiding inside of a trashy, like softcore Cinemax film. But then you realize acting like a softcore Cinemax film is part of Neve Campbell's plot to lure in these dumb shits played by Kevin Bacon and Matt Dillon. Like, that's part of her genius. And then the fact that they then spend the end credits going backwards and showing you how the whole thing gets set up. You know, I remember there's a Roger Ebert review of The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, where he's like, when it first came out, I only gave it 3 stars because in my mind, I'm like, a movie this entertaining can't also be a great film. Like, a great film has got to feel like you've done some work. And it took me till I was older to go, no, actually making a really entertaining movie is also really fucking hard. Like, that also means it's great. And that's what I think about Wild Things is, just because it is insanely entertaining and funny doesn't mean it's also not a great film with some kind of brilliant things to say about masculinity and class warfare and stuff like that. But it just happens to be really, really fun to watch. But it's also genius.
That's a fucking great shout. And you know this. You must know this. They wrote that backwards. You know that? That's how they
Really?
Wrote Wild Things. Yeah, they sort of worked backwards. That's why it's such a great bit of plotting, is they sort of did it.
God, because it felt like the end credit scene was a thing that McNaughton came up with later. Like, oh, wait a minute, we could do this. So in the end credit, you're watching his writing process. Mm-hmm. You're watching how he sets it up. And Neve Campbell is basically the screenwriter of the film, of the plot. But she's using everybody because she's being whatever she needs to be in front of the and it's such a brilliant performance that she does. Yeah. But because, again, it's so trashy and funny and entertaining that I think people are like, well, this can't be a great performance. Like, no, it is. It just is also really entertaining. Like, what the fuck? So, yeah, that's one of those movies that I really think needs a second look.
That's a very good shout.
What's one of yours that you champion?
I think Batman Returns is the best Batman film.
Oh, I got to hear this. Wait, why?
Because Batman Returns is the first feminist superhero film that comes, because Catwoman appears and her whole thing is, she literally says to a woman that needs saving, she says, always stand around waiting for a Batman to save you. Cut. And I love that there's this weird sort of fetish, weird sexual stuff going on. And then there's all this amazing scene where I'm just like, that's such a good idea, where they go to the masked ball and the only two people not in masks are Batman and Catwoman. And it's such a fucking great idea that they've already got masks. They're covered in masks.
And also the idea that, and then when they both realize who each other are and they're like, what are we supposed to do now? That was a cool, now I'm going to go watch that scene, that movie again.
It's a great film. Christopher Walken's mad in it, and it's cool, and it's so odd. And like, for a mainstream big, you know, Hollywood blockbuster film, it's so weird.
And very sexual. And
very
like,
sexual. And the Penguin is genuinely terrifying, I think. I think Danny DeVito is, will give you nightmares, and is not playing for laughs, and he really could do. And their love story, I really love their Batman and Catwoman's love story, because it's so fucking weird, and they can't be together because they're both fucked. It's really interesting.
I gotta check that out again. I saw somebody was passing a meme around about the movie Batman and Robin, and it was a picture of Mr. Freeze and Poison Ivy and Batman. And it was like, he's trying to stop global warming, she's trying to reforest the planet, but we're supposed to root for the trust fund billionaire who beats up poor people. Like, it's just like, wait a minute. That was such a cry. I never thought of that take on it.
Right, yeah.
Holy shit, Batman Returns. I gotta check that movie out again. Now you're right, there's all these weird little elements to it. Oh man.
Yeah, it's really interesting. And Michael Keaton's the best Batman, you know. I won't hear another one.
And I love the fact that they're gonna bring him back, but as this older, scarred, like mentor Batman. There were rumors going around when Heath Ledger tragically passed away, because what an amazing performance as the Joker. Mm-hmm. And people were saying, well, how do we do the third Batman movie? And one of the ideas was, and I don't know why they didn't do this anyway, set the third Batman movie, The Dark Knight Rises, set it 40 years in the future. Batman has been cleaning up Gotham City for 40 years. All of his rogues gallery are in Blackgate Prison, including a now older Joker. Get like Kurt Russell to play the Batman. Now he's all scarred up and he's like, I'm done. And then Bane comes along, lets out all the fucking villains. And then get some older actor to play the Joker, like, and see how he's changed while he's in. Like, that would have been amazing.
That's the one I want to see.
There you go. There you go.
Yeah. Ugh. Okay, well, there's my one. It's Batman Returns. People don't talk about it enough.
I'm gonna check that out. Wow, thanks.
I don't know why people are talking about anything else. What's the film that you used to love? You had great love for it, but then you've watched it recently and you felt, oh no, I don't love this no more.
I still love Ghostbusters, but when, unfortunately, if you watch it through 2020 goggles, the Bill Murray character, and I don't want to be all PC and Me Too, but God, the Bill Murray character is so creepy in that movie. Not just the opening scene with the sophomore, that girl that he's, but like the first time he goes to Sigourney Weaver's apartment, he's all but like lunging at her like this weird, it's really unnerving, like watching that stuff. And then also the fact that the villain is the EPA guy, who, he's a douchebag, but he's like, you guys are, there's like this weird, you kind of built your own nuclear. I don't think you can have this in the middle. Like, people could die. Like, it has such a weird viewpoint. But and still, there's still shit about it that's funny. Look, I still love all the old James Bond movies, but you watch, yeah, like You Only Live Twice, you're going, oh, yikes. Yeah. You know, or there's a movie, a teen comedy that my wife made called Dream a Little Dream, that was as a light, fun comedy for kids that features her mom basically roofies her so that she'll, like, kind of, I guess, sleep with the boyfriend that she's with. It's very, very creepy. Oh, like, yeah, what they like that's there's a Blake Edwards movie called SOB where, yeah, very famously, Julie Andrews shows her, gets naked and shows her tits. But what they leave out is that they basically slip her a roofie so that she's loopy enough to do that on camera, and it's done as, like, comedic. Oh, so there's, like, there was, like, kind of date rapey stuff that was almost done as comedy a lot back then.
Yeah, there's a lot of that.
Yeah, just like all the time. So again, I don't want to be the I can't wait. Like, there's still things about Ghostbusters that's goddamn, yeah, brilliant, but some of the Bill Murray stuff is just really creeps me out, and I don't know.
I think that is totally legit.
And it's like, I don't know if there was that famous article where Molly Ringwald's daughters went and watched, yeah, Breakfast Club with, yeah, her, and she was like, oh, there's some weird shit in here.
Yeah. And creepy. I think you what you're saying is right, as in, it doesn't mean we have to kill Ghostbusters.
No.
But it also, you can sort of enjoy bits of it and also be horrified.
Yeah, and you can, by the way, you can also enjoy how badly things have aged and go, oh, hey, look how far we've come. Like, that can be part of the enjoyment. It's like, oh my God, people thought this was fun, you know, yeah, like, yeah, that can be part of the fun. But yeah, you, and also the dumb anti-PC people will always fall back. This is when you know the argument's going on. They always fall back and like, well, you couldn't make Blazing Saddles today. You know, that movie, mm-hmm, I'm like, hang on. Blazing Saddles, which is about a really intelligent African-American sheriff who comes in, owns a whole town full of dipshit racists, yeah, makes them actually get woke and evolve. Mm. You could totally make that movie today. You're only focusing on the first 5 minutes when they're yelling the N-word, yeah, because that's all you want to do. But if you look at the entire arc of the movie, it's actually about being woke and being PC and how that saves the goddamn day. Yeah. So, like, I just, ugh. And it's amazing how people will, like, compartmentalize and focus always on the wrong shit.
Yeah, it's very true.
Yeah.
Patton, tell me this. What film means the most to you? Not necessarily the film itself is any good, but because the experience you had seeing the film, that will always make it special for you.
You know what? The movie that really, really means the most to me is Pee-wee's Big Adventure. Because that, I remember I saw it. I went to see another movie. I remember this. I was with a bunch of friends. And the movie ended. And this is back in Virginia. Mm-hmm. And a person walked out and said, hey, we have a movie we'd like to preview for you guys, whoever wants to stay. And this is back in suburban Virginia, were like, a movie preview. So the whole crowd stayed, and it was Pee-wee's Big Adventure. And that movie was the first time, because I hadn't quite been exposed to Monty Python as much as I wanted to. I mean, I loved Steve Martin and I loved SNL, but, you know, Pee-wee Herman was a very, very niche cult figure. I hadn't seen him on Letterman. I barely knew. I vaguely kind of knew who he was. And this movie was so, it was the first time that I saw a comedic performer going, we're going to operate on my level. And I'm not doing this to go, fuck you. I'm like, I'm operating on this level. I'm inviting you to come along, but you've got to operate on this weird level. And the whole, this disparate suburban Virginia crowd just got on the frequency. And it was that first time that she's like, oh, you can make what you think is funny palatable to anybody. Mm. And the moment that it really, really clicked in the movie, people love the movie, but there's a great moment in the middle of the movie where the only curse word in Pee-wee's Big Adventure is when he says to Dottie, she goes, you know, you come to Chuck's bike shop and I'll get you a discount on a new bike. And he goes, I don't want some other crappy bike. And when he says crappy, the whole audience went, whoa, like that was part of the joke, is that, yeah, oh, things are getting serious now. So that they're actually in on the joke. And it just made me, And I had no idea about being a comedian. I did know that I wanted to be a writer or do something creative. But that was one of the first indications of just do your own thing and commit to it and people will come along. So that movie has always been really, really special to me for that reason.
How old were you when that happened? Do you remember?
I think it came out in 84 or 85. So I was a teenager. I was maybe 14 or 15 or, you know, just entering high school, trying to figure out how do I be popular? How do I be? And then that was one of those, without ever telling you, it's just like, do what you think is good. You've got to enjoy your life first. You know, like, because if you live other people's lives, you're going to be miserable. So that idea of just go do your own stuff, it makes me so happy.
How you don't have to talk about it a lot. I'm sure you've talked about it loads, but how old were you when you did your first gig?
I was 19 years old. 19 years old. And on the same night, I started out at a club called Garvin's Comedy Club on L Street in Washington, D.C., July 18th. 1988, was 19 years old, who also went up his first time on that same show, Dave Chappelle.
Oh my God.
He was 14 years old. And he annihilated.
Were you like, I've started too late. I should have started younger.
But he had this energy of someone that, talk about old souls. He had the energy of someone who had been doing it for 30 years. Like just walked up, didn't rush to the microphone, started talking like, all right, and you're on my level. Here we are. Right. Oh my God. It was amazing.
How were you on that first gig?
I was the exact opposite. I got, not only did I get, oh God, here's what doomed me. I got no laughs except for one joke that I did, which wasn't even a joke. It was like getting towards the idea of a joke. Mm-hmm. But one comedian in the audience, or one of the other comedians, one of the older ones, gave me the, You ever do that when you acknowledge that your friend is like, I see what you're headed towards something.
Yeah.
But just that I got that acknowledgement from one of the pros was like, I'm in. Like, then I was like, I'm in for life. And also I was like sitting and waiting to go on stage and watching the other comedians sit and talk with each other and, you know, bash jokes around and knock around like that. Like, I'm like, I want that hang. These are the people I want to hang with. So I wanted the hang before I wanted the career. That's what got me into it.
Do you know who made the noise? There's something in it. Do you know who that comic was?
Yeah, it was this guy who I ended up being roommates with years later. This guy named Mark Voice, a comedian out of Baltimore, who was a great writer. One of my favorite lines of his is, you know, it takes all kinds. No, it doesn't. We just have all kinds. And we got to make it work. Like there was just something so That's great about great. That line. So he just, yeah. So to see someone who is that funny, give you the little, okay, there's something.
Keep going.
I'm like, well, I got to show up. I got to keep going.
Does he know that? Have you told him that?
I've told him that. That little, made me go, okay, well, shoot, now I'm doomed.
So funny.
Now I'm
in. Just a noise and you're here. Patton, what film do you most relate to?
The one movie that I keep watching over and over again is the Albert Finney Murder on the Orient Express.
Yeah.
Because I really relate to the way that Hercule Poirot is depicted in that movie. Beyond just, it's not just so much the mystery, is that, and it's all subtext, but he's this guy who is, he's very, very OCD, which I am, and he sometimes can be very prickly with like other people and other relationships, and he's not quite connected with the world as maybe he would want to be. Mm-hmm. And at the end, he has to kind of realize that, yes, all the people on this train did this maybe terrible thing, but the terrible thing in context was part of the messiness of life. And he has to let the messiness of life go at the end, because that's how life is. But he ends up, it's very much that final shot of him walking down the hall alone. It's that something that I've always struggled with, which is a lot of times I feel myself to be a little bit apart from the world. And, you know, luckily I've met people, both friends and my first wife, Michelle, and especially Meredith, who pull me deep. Unlike Hercule Poirot, who just keeps turning away from connections, I keep meeting people who then pull me into life. But I almost see that movie for me as a warning of like, don't end up walking alone down that train hallway while both the messiness of life and maybe even a little bit of the violence of life, but then also there's the beauty of life is happening. Don't end up walking away from it the way that Albert Finney does in that brilliant, brilliant movie.
Best answer I've ever had to that question.
I mean, you've seen that movie, haven't you? Mm-hmm. The Albert Finney one. I mean, it's, yeah. Again, it's on its surface because it's Sidney Lumet who directed it. So the dude that made Dog Day Afternoon and Serpico, then goes and does Murder on the Orient Express, where now the surface is this glittering, very posh, very between world wars dead zone of opulence and grotesquerie. But life is trying to push through. And there's this guy that has to kind of decide, I've got to let life go here. It's amazing. It's worth watching again to see all that stuff that's hidden in there.
That's so fascinating, man. Do you think, if I may, I was asked on a thing, it was like, why do you do comedy? Like, why comedy? And they asked me, they said, is it because you think you're funny? Is it you always thought you're funny? And I was like, no, that isn't why I do. I think it's because I always felt on the outside looking in.
Yes.
Separate.
Yeah.
And I felt it from like when I was at school, I felt it like 5 years old at school, just sort of looking around going, the fuck is this? But I felt like everyone else was in it and I was just separate and observing and thinking everything was mad. Is that?
Yeah, it felt like I had missed one beat in something and everyone else had clicked, their cogs had clicked into a part of the sprocket that mine hadn't quite clicked into. And I was trying to find a way to segue into it. And the only way to, because the gears were going to grind when I segued into it, and it was going to be loud and embarrassing. So I would try to cover that up with being funny and stuff. Like that's, I think a lot of comedians, because a lot of us, it's about how all the best comedy is about how you're not quite in sync with the world. And what's funny is because I'm not in sync, I'm noticing this thing that maybe the rest of you don't notice. You know, and then as you get older, you're starting to notice things about yourself that you've been hiding from yourself, which is even funnier. Yeah. You're like, oh, here's like this total thing I was bullshitting myself about, but here's what I actually do.
The thing in the box you hadn't acknowledged.
The thing, goddamn, that's right. It's these, as you get older, you're, especially as a comedian, you're picking up these objects in the box like, the fuck, what is, you know, that's what you're doing. What? Why do I have this?
What use is this?
Holy shit, that's a great way to think of it. That's what working out the material is.
Yeah.
Holy shit.
This is really good therapy.
God damn.
For me. I don't know how you're experiencing this.
This is really helpful.
I realized I forgot to ask you and people will be furious. Oh. What's the film that made you laugh the most?
I got to say, I mean, I know I should pick some classic comedy, but and I was one of the early writers on it, but the first fucking Borat movie, there are sequences in that where I was like, am I gonna throw up? Like I'm laughing so much. It's just so non-stop and relentless. That writer Anthony Hines is just, we were in the room where he came up with the line, my wife's vagine looks like the sleeve of a wizard. And it was like, get the fuck up and run a victory lap. You've earned it. Like, it was so goddamn amazing. So, yeah, that, and again, that movie, I did not expect it to come out as good as that did, you know. But, and if you're talking about like just a classic movie that makes me laugh my ass off, W.C. Fields, It's a Gift, there are moments in that where it's like a rough version of The Simpsons, basically, really? Where they're just this asshole family. They're so fucking stupid and just unapologetic slobs. And he just has so much fun. It's just, I mean, again, I know you're supposed to, people go, we respect the old comedians, but that is, by today's standards, that is a genuinely like, oh, fuck, I'm laughing my ass off. This is really funny.
Love that. Here we go. What's the film that you found the sexiest? And you can't say Batman Returns because I've already said it.
There's all kinds of sexy moments in movies that are blatantly sexy. Betsy Russell seducing Matthew Modine in Private School, just total teen comedy. And Christy Hartberg dancing towards the payphone in Super Vixens and the halter top. But there's a scene in an old Humphrey Bogart movie called The Big Sleep. And it, Dorothy Malone, she just has one scene. She's the bookshop girl. And it's a very sexist scene because it's all about, she like takes her glasses off. And when she has her glasses on, she's the most gorgeous woman you've ever fucking seen. Why did she have to take her goddamn glasses off? But she takes her glasses off and kind of lets her hair out to kind of seduce Humphrey Bogart. And she does this little thing where she's coming up behind him and she just kind of, like that, it's this little gesture, and it just, to see that in a 1945 black and white film, this very physical, very like just human heat coming off of a person, but in black and white, is so goddamn startling. It's still that moment is like, okay. all right. Yeah.
Hello,
what
Dorothy.
The fuck? I just watching this goddamn Humphrey Bogart movie. And I gotta pause it for like maybe 10 minutes and
take a walk. I gotta take a walk.
And there's a similar scene in a movie called Phantom Lady around this. I think maybe that was 1941, but there's an actress named Ella Raines. And there's a scene where she has to seduce Elijah Cook Jr., who's playing this jazz drummer. And he's basically drumming while he's watching her. And she's like kind of moving to the drum beat. And he's jerking off while he's, like, and they snuck it into this 1940, the way it's shot, it looks like he's like jerking off while she, and she's so goddamned hot. And because it's not that she's naked or something, it's that she is, you know what, I want to fuck you. Like, it's that I'm deciding. When an intelligent woman is turned on and interested in you, that is so much more of a turn on than just a nude body lit with, you know, blue gels and stuff like that. There's more like, oh my God, I've actually engaged this person. Holy fuck, how did I do that? So that to me, that's what always turns me on in movies.
That's a great answer. Well, yeah. Pan, there's a subcategory to this question.
Uh-oh.
Troubling boners, worrying wide-ons. And it's a film you found arousing that you thought perhaps you shouldn't
have. Oh, boy.
Or that you were like, I don't think that was meant to be sexy, but I found it sexy.
Right, exactly. You're like, oh, I don't know if that was supposed to be.
Yeah.
I gotta say, there's a movie called The Honeymoon Killers, the only movie that was ever directed by this guy named Leonard Castle. And it was Martin Scorsese's first directing job, and he got fired.
No.
Because he shot for 2 weeks, but he was being so artsy-fartsy and pretentious. And he says this, he goes, I was trying to do all these complicated master shots. I've been hired to do an exploitation movie, The Honeymoon Killers, right, with Tony Lobianco and Shirley Stoller. Shirley Stoller is supposed to play, and it's based on these real-life murderers, the Lonely Hearts Killers. Mm-hmm. And she plays this overweight, kind of mean, you know, pissy nurse who's just like, man. And she falls in love with this guy, Tony, and they lure lonely women and they kill them for their money. And Shirley Stoller she's supposed to be playing kind of this repellent, unpleasant woman, but there is something about her performance. And also she plays a similar character in a movie called Seven Beauties, where she plays a Nazi camp commandant, like a Irma Greiss type, right, this, you know, she-wolf type. You're watching an actor so comfortable in their skin that I don't know what it is about those two movies, especially, are such a turn on for me. When she is in Seven Beauties in her man's boxer shorts, smoking a cigar with her hair just knotted back, no attempt at being hot. You're just like, why the fuck is this turning me on so much? I should not be goddamn turned on by this woman who is openly playing like this monster.
Yeah.
But I don't know what it is about, but Shirley Stoller, there's something about her, man.
Fascinating.
Isn't that weird?
You like a woman who is comfortable. She's comfortable with herself.
Who's comfortable, but also like clearly in Seven Beauties, like, when the guy is trying to seduce her, and it's very clear that I'm probably just going to fuck this guy and then kill him. I'm just bored. And there's something really weirdly seductive about, oh my God, I can't believe I'm saying this. But yeah, it's just, oh God.
You know, if you're having sex and knowing that you're going to be killed at the end of it, that's exciting sex.
Yeah, that's, okay, I'll take it.
That's great sex. And you'll try and make it last. The point is this, next question, Patton.
Oh, God.
What is objectively the greatest film of all time? Not your favorite, objectively.
Right.
The pinnacle of cinema. What is it?
I'm going to, just because I just watched it again recently and I did a deep dive reading about it, objectively, I would say Casablanca, because it wasn't made under, it was just, let's shoot this in 2 weeks. It was another one of Michael, I think he shot like four movies that year. Everyone else was on contract. They had a pretty okay, it was a known stage play. It wasn't great. Can we do something? And they somehow, under all these horrible conditions, and half of the cast were refugees fleeing Hitler's Europe, and Hitler was still, had not lost yet, and they made this blatantly used what should have been just a throwaway melodrama and ended up making this movie that said so much about democracy and humanity and sacrifice and love, but none of it was shot none of it was made under the conditions of we are making something real. It was like these were people showing up to work, and out of all of their professionalism and creativity, they made a movie that does not have a bad scene. It like, to me, that is like the magic of movie making. When you show up to work and then out of the work comes a masterpiece, you know, like, and look, Citizen Kane is a great movie, but they knew they were doing something amazing. Yeah. And sometimes there is this feeling of like, you're welcome. We're giving you something amazing here. Casablanca is like, we hope you're entertained. There's some kissing and there's some shooting. And
there's
but then
so many jokes in it.
So much. Oh my God. There's some, not just jokes, but dialogue that is now just part of our vernacular. Yeah. That is just put, like, is used for shorthand for things. So that kind of, to me, that is objectively the greatest movie ever made.
Correct.
Thank you. Oh, I got it right. You got yes.
what is the film that you could or have watched the most over and over again?
I think with me, it's a tie between Murder on the Orient Express, Albert Finney, or Midnight Run.
Oh, nice.
Midnight Run, another movie where just, yeah, it's a fun, you know, chase movie with gangsters and stuff, but then there's all these little moments that don't need to be in there that are there that, oh, this is going to make me cry. I always get teared up when, two moments. One, when after he sees his ex-wife and then they borrow the car and Charles Grodin is in the passenger seat and he tucks Charles Grodin's overcoat into the door the way he would probably tuck his wife's, because his wife's like, it's a very big night tonight. I'm going out. So he's subconsciously thinking, oh, that's what I would have done if I was taken out for a special night. Yeah. And he tucks that in. And then also the moment at the end, talk about things that make me cry movies. The whole movie, De Niro's like, you're just a paycheck. I could give a fuck what you did. I don't care. Whatever. Fine. You're just money. I'm just taking you in. Then that thing at the airport where they bring him out and he says to Charles, he goes, get behind me. Just stand behind me. Like I'm going to protect you now. And it's just a little gesture, but oh, it's so good. I just love it so much. That's nice. And then also the moment when he goes up to Jimmy Serrano, the gangster, and he's like, there's something I've wanted to say to you for 9 years. And you're thinking it's gonna be like, fuck you, motherfucker. He goes, what's that? He goes, you're under arrest. Just, that's it. That's all you're worth. Man, it's just so, I love it. Right. Yeah. So I've seen that movie so many times.
I like that. Now listen, here's the thing. We don't like to be too negative, so we'll do it fairly swiftly, but
okay.
What's the worst film you ever seen? And taking into account all films are impossible to make.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah, that's a hard thing because, yes, I know films are hard to make and blah, blah, blah. I think one of the worst films I've ever seen, just in terms of you could just feel everyone just kind of giving up while they make it, if that makes sense, is unfortunately Batman and Robin. And, you know, there are a lot of talented people in that movie, but there's a lot of moments. Mm. And the one that really stands out to me is when George Clooney, who I think is a terrific actor, And Bruce Wayne is dedicating the observatory in Gotham. And if you watch George Clooney's hands, he's standing at a railing and he's like, and my father said that with this, Gotham can then look to the stars. And he's just like kind of drumming on the rail, like, ah, fuck this movie. Like I did. He's doing the equivalent of like when someone's hugging you and then they pat you on the back, like I'm not hooking up with you. Like this is not happening. Like he's literally patting the movie on the back. Like I'm really not. But it's almost to his credit that he like realized halfway through, this isn't working. I'm just gonna, that little moment to me just so took me out of the movie and it made me tired. Like you felt everyone's exhaustion on that movie. And everyone showed up, like they tried, you know, Schwarzenegger tries every movie he does. He shows the fuck up. He came in weeks early, tried on every goddamn Mr. Freeze outfit, did makeup tests, and Uma Thurman fucking showed up. And it's all for naught. It's just for nothing. And that little, when he's tapping that little rail, you're like, oh God, this movie. I don't know why that moment has haunted me. Because you realize you will... every movie we show up to, we do. You want it to be good, but you're going to show up to some project, a TV show or a movie, where you're like, okay, we just got to get this over with.
Yeah.
We just got to get this over with. What the fuck am I going to do? You know? Oh, you know that's in your future.
I've experienced that a few times.
I'm sure you have. I'm sure you've had a little like, we're just tapping the rail now. Let's get this done.
Although I've always found that the jobs that were like that were also often where you made the strongest friendships because you're surviving and you're just like,
oh my god, yeah, you bond so well when you're in a movie that's going really well and you feel like it's good. It's not that you don't become like, I'm really good friends with Charlize, but it wasn't like, let's go get fucked up every night, because you're like, no, I want to show up tomorrow and do good
really
work.
Good, yeah.
But there's other movies where you're like, we may as well just go drinking. I mean, this is let's fucking enjoy ourselves on this. There's apparently, what's the movie Beckett with Richard Harris and Peter O'Toole, where I think there's a scene where they got to put he puts the ring on him and they had to like speed the film up because they were both trembling so much because all they would do is just go drinking. And like Beckett wasn't even a bad movie, but they're just like, fuck this. So I'm sure there's a lot of movies where clearly people, apparently if you watch Empire Strikes Back, which is a great movie, but I'm sure as an actor, those movies could not have been that much fun to be in because it's more about the special effects. When Harrison Ford and Carrie Fisher first get to Cloud City, they're apparently way too smiley and giggly because they had stayed up all night the night before. They went over to Eric Idle's and were drinking and doing coke. And then Mick Jagger showed up and they went, well, our call time is 7. Let's just keep going. And they just, they just kind of showed up high and they just did the scenes.
That's great.
Yeah.
That's great.
Like, fuck it. Way as well. Yeah. This movie's not about us. It's about the goddamn spaceship and the, you know.
No one's going to notice how high we are.
Who gives a shit? So yeah, like that kind of feeling. Yeah. You're right. Yeah, it's the bad experiences where you end up going, oh my god, we became the best of friends because it was.
Yeah, we'll be friends for life.
Yeah,
and also because you have that sort of secret because you're not really allowed to talk about it, right? You sort of have to.
No.
So you have.
Oh, and isn't it great later on when you guys are doing the press tour and you have to? Well, I mean, you know, when you work on a movie like this, it's just every day is like, and you're all kind of looking at each other like, the fuck are we doing?
God. Yeah,
it's the best. Yeah, you gotta go do the work.
But listen, luckiest people in the world.
Oh my god, I'm never. You kid. I remember I was doing. I've done a lot of movies with Owen Wilson, and he would always come on set and go like, he would do this fake. He's like, another day, another dollar. You know, who's the shop steward here? God damn! Like he would act like he's having to go work like a job at a tire store. it would crack me up so much.
That's great, Pan. You have been incredible, a dream, and I'm grateful. However,
thank you.
When you went for your 34 course tasting meal at the laundry, dirty laundry, what was it?
French laundry.
You had
dinner at
the dirty laundry.
You went to the laundry hamper.
Do you remember the famous restaurant, the Dirty Laundry? And you went there for 34, you were with Brad Bird, Christopher Nolan, Paul Thomas Anderson.
Yeah.
You were having a lovely time. And Paul was like, we're going to play Baccarat later, all back to mine. Well, great. You were like, yeah. And everyone was like, they got to the last quiz. They were like, everyone was like, you know what? I'm stuffed. I don't need this mocha crystal egg. But you were like, I got this. And you ate the egg. The crystalline.
I had to show off.
Listen, you were trying to impress. I get it.
Yeah.
The crystal broke off, sliced up your throat. You started choking and bleeding. Weirdly, Nolan just stared at you, sort of making calculations of some kind. Who's the other one?
Paul Thomas Anderson and Brad Bird.
Brad Bird took his phone out under the table and he started making notes, like just observing this. And Paul Thomas Anderson just did a beautiful drawing of it. And you, but you were looking at them all like, I appreciate you're all, you know, seeing art in this, but I am dying, but you couldn't say this because of the thing. Anyway, you choked, you fell on the ground and you bled to death. But because you're also a comedian, they thought, maybe that was a bit. He was doing a bit. Maybe he was doing a bit. All back to mine. We'll go play Baccarat. So they left you there thinking he's committing to this bit. He's not getting up. Anyway, I haven't heard from Patton in a while, and you know, you and I always talk. I'm like, I haven't heard from him in a while. So I go to the restaurant, and it's been shut down because of the name Dirty Laundry. It turned out it wasn't very popular. Years have passed. I've gone into this now abandoned building and I find this tablecloth over it. I pull out the tablecloth. You're there, a rotted corpse. You've been eaten by rats. Stuff's growing out of you. It's an absolute nightmare. I brought a coffin that was your size, but I wasn't expecting all these growths and shit that's on top of you. So I had to chop you up with an old axe I found. I put you in the coffin. I have to stuff you in the coffin, right? But there was more of you than I was expecting. The coffin is absolutely rammed. There is only enough room in this coffin that I can slip one DVD in the side with you. You can take across to the other side. Now, on the other side, it's movie night every night. One night, it's going to be your movie night. What film are you taking to show everyone in heaven when it's your movie night, Patton Oswalt?
Oh, if it's movie night in heaven, mm-hmm. I'm going to get to show people a movie.
Yeah, and you present it and everything.
You know what movie I would take with me? I would take, God damn it, I would take Smokey and the Bandit.
What?
Movie night in heaven? I would take Smokey and the Bandit because that's the summer Star Wars came out, Saturday Night Fever, all these like, but then goddamn Smokey and the Bandit, it was like this reminder of like cinema is also can be the most fun, goofy, kind of loose. There's scenes that, here's what's weird. Everyone thinks that Smokey and the Bandit is some dumb goddamn redneck moonshiner chase thing, but there's sequences with Bert and Sally Field that were clearly improvised. They just go, let's just let the camera roll and let these two talk. And in the middle of this very fun chase movie with Jackie Gleason being goddamn hilarious and Jerry sang the theme song. I'm blanking on his name. It'll come to me in a second.
Okay.
But they're like doing this Altman shit in the middle of, it's such a weird microcosm of this is 1970s America, mm-hmm. and we just captured it on... Jerry Reed is the snowman. We just captured it on film just for a second when there was a time when things were just kind of casual and fun, and Jimmy Carter's president, and America's actually kind of relaxing with itself and just kind of going, all right, you know, maybe we're not number one, but we can still be nice to people. I don't know. There was just something kind of fun about it.
We could be a cool number two.
Yeah.
We'll be a cool number two.
Exactly. If we could be a cool number two. So bringing that attitude up to heaven going, yeah, there were some nice moments in America.
That's a wonderful answer. Patton?
Yeah.
You have been a joy and a delight. Before we say goodbye, is there anything you would like to tell people to watch other than I Love Everything, which I think is your newest thing? Do you have is there anything?
Well, I mean, if you're talking about my own stuff, mm-hmm. AP Bio is on Peacock. But again, and I know you're sick of hearing this from me, goddamn Ted Lasso on Apple TV. I literally think if people would fucking watch this show, it would make the world better. You would actually treat people better if you watched this show. And you'd also, by the way, you'd laugh your ass off. You would laugh your ass off, and especially Brett, who was amazing in it.
Oh, God.
Yeah. I'm telling you, every celebrity I know, when they watch the scene of you going down the red carpet, everyone's all going to secretly go, fucking yes. God damn it. I want to do that so badly. That was, you got to live the fucking dream. Oh.
How much do I owe you for this?
You owe me 8 more seasons of Ted Lasso. That's what you owe me.
Okay.
God damn it.
Patton Oswalt, what a fucking dream you are. Thank you very much for doing this. I really appreciate your time, and it's been a lot of it.
I want this goddamn COVID to end so I can come over to London and we can either watch movies or you come visit us and you and I can just go on a crazy movie binge or something. I'll take you to Tarantino's screening room. I don't mind dropping a name. I'll take you to a screening room and watch a fucking movie.
What?
Yeah. Wait till you hear that guy's insights on movies. You're just like, what the fuck? Oh my God. He's one of those guys when you watch a movie with, afterwards you're like, I don't think I've ever really watched a movie. If that's how you look at movies, holy shit.
That's great.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I've got that on tape. So
good.
We'll hold you to it. Let's go and do a gig together. I'll take you to,
yes.
I'll take you to an absolute shit out in London. We'll have a great time. You will love it. God,
I want to do a fucking one nighter out in the Cotswolds, like way out in the country or something. Now I'm blanking on it too. What's the classic? One of the greatest British movies ever made with Richard E. Grant and
With Nail and I.
I want to do a With Nail and I. One of the greatest movies ever made.
We'll do it
ever.
With Nail and I. Okay.
Yeah. All right.
Patton, I'm going to stop the recording. I thank you so much.
Brett, thank you.
Sometimes I dream of becoming an actor. Have you ever dreamt of becoming an actor? Maureen, what is it you think I do for a living? Never mind, sounds like you need the New York Film Academy. NYFA offers workshops, BFA and MFA degrees, and summer camps in filmmaking, acting, journalism, and more, online and on campuses across the globe. To make films alongside industry professionals, explore more at nyfa.edu. Thanks, Brett. Thank you, Maureen.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.